I wouldn't trade being a mom for the world, but it's also a full-time job. And that means sometimes I get less sleep than I'd like. So I make the most of the hours of sleep I do get with Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding products. Cozy Earth bedding products are crafted with temperature-regulating technology that adapts to your body's needs through all phases of motherhood. And they use only the very best fabrics, materials, and weaves, offering superior softness that invites you to sink into a world of comfort. I have the king sheets for my bed, the entire set, and I swear to you, it's like you can't wait to get in and you never want to get out. If you're a commitment phobe, that's totally fine because Cozy Earth stands by the quality and longevity of their products, so much so that you can enjoy a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty on all purchases. And just for our listeners, Cozy Earth has an exclusive Mother's Day offer. Use the code Jillian for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. That's CozyEarth.com. Cozy Earth, built to last through the hardest days and the longest nights of motherhood.
When you need to refuel between meetings or running errands, or you just want a healthy snack that squashes your hunger, Wonderful Pistachios, which come in a variety of flavors and sizes, by the way, are the perfect choice to fill you up and keep you going throughout the day. Wonderful Pistachios is also a good source of protein and a zero guilt snack. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, guys, which gives you over 10% of your daily value. And with flavors like salt and pepper, sweet chili, and seasoned salt in the shelled variety, options like chili roasted, sea salt, and vinegar or jalapeno lime in the no shell variety, you're sure to please your taste buds while snacking healthy. So check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about how these little green wonders can power up your day.
Y'all ready for this?
Welcome to the Jillian Michaels and
Janice.
No, I'm just leaving you out today.
Janice.
No, you're out. I feel like this is like The Simpsons, this show. You know that every time they open the show, there's like a different opening. Like they're flying in, or like they're boating in on a submarine, or it's like they're skateboarding in. They sit in different places on the couch. Every opening of The Simpsons is a different one.
Yeah. See, with Paul and I, like, we just wait here. We just wait and watch
to
and
see
wonder
what's
what the show's gonna be called today.
I'm gonna start speaking Japanese.
Okay.
Like, you know, oh, kudasai. Oh, Jillian, hola. Konnichiwa. Arigato. Janice. Like that. Oh, maybe I'll do like Mandarin.
Mandarin? You don't know. Do you know another language yet?
Yeah, of course. I know Spanish, and you insulted me when I spoke my Spanish.
Oh, well, it wasn't good.
What are you talking about? It was perfect.
It was?
I was like, hola, hello. Me llamo Jillian. My name is Jillian. E and mi amiga. That's you, my friend, Janice.
Janice. No, that's good.
That
I thought you were
going
to learn French. Remember
where
we talked?
Where did you get that from?
You said you were going to learn French.
I never said I was going to learn French.
So that we don't get Alzheimer's.
Are you been hitting the crack pipe?
I
never said I was going to learn French. A couple episodes ago, she called me a wiener. She talked about me pooping in my space suit, jumping off of the tower in New Zealand. What are you talking about?
You know what?
I never said I was going to learn French.
I think you did.
No.
No, because remember we said to each other, we're going to learn a different language because how when people are concerned about Alzheimer's, one of the ways you can fight Alzheimer's is learn a different language because it works different grooves in your brain.
You think I offered up French?
I think you said French.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
and I said Spanish. And you copied me. You want to be just like
but
me.
But right now, I'm never going to speak Spanish again. I will never.
I think you copied.
Speak the Spanish again. Okay. We want to talk about plateaus. I'm so sick of this question because here's the thing. I doubt that you're actually plateauing. I doubt it. I doubt it. And no matter where I go these days, and I've been doing a lot of stuff with public speaking, whether it's for the book or it's for charity, I've been doing conferences, blah, 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 and I keep getting the same question. I plateaued and I hate it. I doubt that you've plateaued. I don't even believe in a weight loss plateau anymore. If I can take somebody through 3, 4, 5, 6 months of weight loss, and every week have them lose weight, it doesn't exist.
So is it boredom?
It's a, okay, two things. Generally, a plateau is a lack of attention to detail. Let's say you started out your program and you changed a few things. You gave up soda. You started counting points on Weight Watchers. You did something. You made a change. And you were eating previously thousands of calories. You were eating 3,000 calories a day, 4,000 calories a day. You made that shift in your diet, and the body's going to respond, and it's going to lose weight. But then you go, oh, no, I've plateaued. No, you haven't plateaued. You just haven't pursued your weight loss in the right way. Weight loss is calories in, calories out. Often people are not counting the calories in, or they're not counting the calories out. When you make a dramatic change to your diet, like cutting out soda or changing your food habits, yeah, you're going to see a big shift. You're going to drop 5, 10, 15, even for men, 20 pounds in the first month because of the dramatic change. But then the body adapts to that. So you're not going from 4,000 calories a day to, 3,000 calories a day. You're shifting, and after you get that hit from the shift initially, the body adapts. You have to create a consistent calorie deficit. So I don't ever want to hear that you've plateaued if you're not counting your calories in and you are not counting your calories out. Another woman came up to me, I've plateaued. Really? Are you counting your calories in? Yeah. Do you work out? No. Well, there's your problem. We go right from eating a bunch of junk, getting that initial hit from the diet change, but not consistently creating a calorie deficit via exercise. So I'm telling you right now that if you're accurate with the amount of food you're taking in versus the amount of calories that are going out, you will not hit a plateau. And when you think, oh, I watch Biggest Loser, I've seen those contestants have bad weeks. That's not what's happening. Here's what's happening. When you see them have a bad week, it has to do with a fluid shift. They're either sick, or they're stressed out, or their electrolytes became imbalanced, and they're holding on to fluid. And then you'll see the following week, they'll have a gigantic number because their body released some of the fluid they were holding on to. It's not a plateau. Never. And for the most part, we figured out how to completely avoid those weeks where it's like, oh, I lost nothing. And it had to do with stabilizing the contestants' electrolytes. It took me 5 seasons to figure it out. But when I finally figured it out on season 5, I figured it out. So now let's presume, let's say you're at home going, Jillian, you couldn't be more wrong. I count my calories in, I count my calories out, and the scale won't move. Well, the only time that I could believe that to be true is presumably if you're trying to lose vanity pounds. I see this a lot with vanity pound people. People with 5, 10, 15, 20 pounds to lose. This is a very different animal than somebody who has 100 pounds to lose. Because the body doesn't want to be 100 pounds overweight.
Right.
When you're 100 pounds overweight, it's like, woo, we got to drop this. Let's go. This is awesome. Woo, we're working out. We're eating right. Let's go. Let's go. It's stoked. It's happy. When you have that small amount that you don't like aesthetically, it doesn't mean that your body thinks it's unhealthy. In fact, I know a lot of people who work out. They'll go, oh, I work out 5 days a week, sometimes 6 days a week. I eat great. I eat 1,200 calories a day. I can't get rid of my blank muffin top, this, that, the other. The reason is because your body is healthy. It's like, I'll say to them, do you have high blood pressure? No. Is your cholesterol in check? Yes. We go through all the sort of, checks and balances of indication with regard to their health, diabetes, blood sugar, cholesterol, heart disease, all of it. It all checks out. So it's not that their body is unhealthy anymore. They don't like the aesthetic. When you have vanity pounds that your body doesn't want to lose because it considers that healthy, and you have too high of a calorie deficit, you're going to slow your metabolism down. So think about it. If you've got 15 pounds to lose and you're working out an hour a day, you're burning around 3,000 calories, but you're eating 1,200, 1,800 calorie deficit, it's too high. Your body's going to go, oh my gosh, we're starving. It interprets that as a starvation mode. And that's when it will signal your biochemistry to slow down. So if you're overtraining under that pretense, you're burning too many calories with vanity pounds, you need to decrease your calorie burn to turn your metabolism and your biochemistry back on. That's how you trick your body into losing those vanity pounds. And you should have a calorie deficit of no more, and I mean no more, then 1,000 calories a day. The sweet spot really is about 700 calories a day. 500 is perfectly safe. You could go a little higher. 1,000 is really right on the edge of hitting a, quote, plateau. Now, let's presume that I'm wrong about all of it. You're now obese, and you're obese, and you are getting a 2,000 calorie deficit a day, a 1,500 calorie deficit a day, and you're not seeing any changes. You can't figure it out. You can do a couple of things. Number one, change your workout. Make sure that you constantly change the workout because the body will adapt to a workout. Right. So you want to constantly keep the body challenged. If you did 10 push-ups today and you haven't done push-ups in a year, you'd be sore tomorrow. Do 10 push-ups for 10 days. You're not going to be sore on the 10th day. The body adapts. Mix up your routine. That's critical. But if that's not working, if it's truly not working, if you're counting all the calories, you're being really diligent, you have over 25 pounds to lose, you've got a significant deficit and weight's not coming off, now we're talking about a hormone imbalance. Now we're talking about maybe PCOS. We could be talking about insulin resistance. We could be talking about a thyroid disorder. That's when you need to go to the endocrinologist. That's when something is wrong. Mm. And I've yet to be incorrect when someone comes to me and says, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this. I run through all the checks and balances. I'm eating right. I'm working out. I have this much, you know, 25, 30, 40, 50 pounds to lose. And I haven't lost a pound. And I'll say, okay, something's probably going on with your hormones. Yes, I had a hysterectomy and they haven't been able to stabilize my estrogen. Or, yeah, I was diagnosed with PCOS a few years ago. That's when you need to see an endocrinologist and get your hormones balanced. But 99.9% of the time, it's the stuff I already mentioned of you not tracking your calories, you not being diligent about changing up your exercise routine, you either having too significant of a calorie deficit when you're trying to get rid of vanity pounds. And the last thought on this is a lot of times people will say, all right, Jillian, I'm eating 1,400 calories a day and I'm not losing weight. Oh, okay. Well, what do you mean you're not losing weight? Well, you know, I lost 2 pounds all month long. Okay. Without understanding that the body, let's say their base metabolic rate is 1,400. And then they run around, or 1,500, or 1,600, or 1,700. Let's say it's 1,700, because I'm a small person. Mine's 1,400, but I'm unusually small. I'm like a little dwarf. So that's the first thing people say to me. They come up to me and they go like this. Oh, you're so small. Humiliating. Yeah. So, whatever. So, fine. Let's say your metabolism is 1,700 calories. You work out. You know, you get to 2,000 calories. Okay, great. Let's say you're burning, you know, 600 calories a day. That's a lot if you're working out. A lot of times they just eat 1,400 calories, but they don't go to the gym.
Right.
So they're burning about 1,700. Well, at 300 calorie deficit a day, it's going to take you 12 days to lose 1 pound. That's why exercise is so critical. That's where you create the massive deficit. That's how I accelerated weight loss on Biggest Loser, was the way that I programmed their training. Sure, I created their diet. I put them on the right diet. I managed their foods, the quality of their foods. I stabilized their electrolytes. I did all that. I optimized their diet. But to get those big numbers, I had to program their workouts accordingly. It was all calorie deficit via exercise. That's
so
it.
Damn mathematical. I mean, I don't mean to.
You're right. But you got to have the information. And at the end of the day, it really is just simple addition and subtraction. And you can get tools to help you. You know, you get a body bug. Yeah. You get a heart rate monitor with a calorie counter, and it'll do it for you. At the end of the day, it'll say, oh, Janice, you've burned 2,000 calories. And then, we're creatures of habit. You eat the same things pretty much. I have the same 5 breakfasts. I have the same 5 dinners. I have the same 5 snacks. Think about it.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah.
It's like, what do I want tonight? Do I want my Thai spring rolls, you know, from my little Thai place down the street? Or do I want to go for sushi to my sushi spot down the street? Or do I want to make that chili for my cookbook? Or do I, you know, I have my 5 dinners, just like I have my 5 breakfasts. And once you know the calories in each of your routine meals, it's that simple. You go, oh, yeah, that's this much, that's that much, that's this much. Oh, my body bug says I burned this much. I burned 800 calories today. Knowledge is power. I don't want to hear you plateaued. When I hear plateau, I hear I don't have the information, or simultaneously, I'm not doing the work. It's one, the other, or both at the same time. So don't step to me with that. It pisses me off.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, take note of that. Ixnay on the plateau.
What's coming up next?
Hey, we got to take a breather because Myrtle's coming on today.
Myrtle!
Yes.
I love Myrtle.
Yeah.
You're going to love her. She is bad. A double money sign.
I'm looking forward to her.
Yeah. She is so cool. We'll be right back. And today I have a very special guest that I am so excited to share with you, a lady named Myrtle Potter, and she is what we call the trusted voice in healthcare. Let me explain. Basically, Myrtle is a woman who ran a $4 billion company, Bristol Myers & Squibb. She also ran Genentech, which is the most successful biotech company in the world. This woman is incredible. She knows the healthcare system inside and out. But one day, something happened to our friend Myrtle that changed the course of her life. So, in fact, I'm going to let Myrtle share that story with you and give you a little background on why she's doing what she's doing today, who she is, and how she can help you. Myrtle, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jillian.
Hi, buddy. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
So when we first met, we met because Myrtle is on the board of directors at a company I work with called Everyday Health. And when we sat down and she told me what she's doing and her story, I was blown away and begged her to come on the show and talk with my callers and take their questions. So, Myrtle, will you retell the story, please, about how you had this massive shift in your career to wanting to help people navigate the healthcare system?
Yes. So about 5 years ago, I had a very serious horseback riding accident, and after a couple of surgeries, I was given a medication to stop the formation of scar tissue in my shoulder. Well, without knowing it, Jillian, I ended up being deathly allergic to this medication. I ended up with failing liver, failing lungs, and total kidney failure. And in fact, I literally almost died. And when I came out of my situation, I just sat back and asked one simple question, and that is, how in the world did that happen to me? And I also asked, what could I have done along the way that would have made a difference in the outcome for my care? And based on all of that, Jillian, I decided, and of course, after talking to lots of people and sharing my story, that I probably had something that I could give to others in terms of helping them get through the system so that no one had a situation happen to them like what happened to me.
I think that so many people feel so overwhelmed by the healthcare system, even understanding your insurance. It's like HMO, PPO. It is so incredibly overwhelming. And to hear that someone like yourself who knew the business inside and out, who had all the resources. When you told me the story of how you're in the hospital and you have two kids, you're a single mom, and the doctor walked in and told you to get your affairs in order because you were going to die, that was shocking to me. Shocking. And so the fact that you came back from that, got your health together, and have now completely dedicated your life to helping people in these kinds of situations is completely, utterly and totally inspiring. And you have a segment that you talked to me about that I wanted to do today, and it's the five prescriptions your doctor won't give you, that you won't find in your doctor's bag. Can you tell me about that? Can you start me out with prescription number one?
Sure. Prescription number one is really simple, Jillian. It's getting the best doctor, not the nicest doctor. More often than not, when I speak to people looking for physicians, they focus a lot on how nice someone is to them.
That's so true.
And my number one message is that the nicest person isn't necessarily the best person. Never sacrifice nice for the best.
How do you find the best doctor? What is the best way to go about figuring that out?
I think it's very important to, number one, understand where someone received their education, their medical school training, and I even ask about their undergraduate work. You want to make sure someone has gone to a reputable school. I also like to fundamentally determine whether or not someone, in fact, is board certified. Being board certified is really important. It means that every single year, your doctor has to go through a series of exams and tests that basically say, if he or she passes them, that he or she is qualified to practice medicine in their desired field.
Are you telling me that someone cannot be board certified and practice medicine?
In this country, you would be surprised at the number of physicians who don't have their board certification, but who will still hang up a shingle and claim that they're practicing physicians. It's also really important to make sure that your physician doesn't have, you know, questionable history, that they haven't been involved in criminal investigations or other types of investigations.
Where could you find that information?
You can oftentimes find that information online and also at your state accreditation board. The state medical boards in most states in this country have information around your physician standing.
I love that while I'm interviewing you, I'm taking notes. I just realized that. I was like, wait a minute. I'm supposed to be doing the segment. What am I doing? I'm sitting here. I'm like, board certification, standardized medical board. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you. All right. Prescription number two.
Prescription number two really speaks to the value of seeking out help from a university hospital if your situation gets complex enough. Our local community hospitals are really great and can solve very complex problems. However, there are a couple of instances when I, even myself or my family, I will go to a university hospital. Number one, if I happen to have been diagnosed with a rare disease, or number two, if I've been diagnosed for a disease that I'm receiving treatment for, but for which I'm not getting better. If you have been treated for something over and over again and you're not seeing progress, then in that situation, I would always go to a university. And the reason why going to a university is so valuable is because universities see more difficult cases more often than not.
Okay.
And the more times a physician expert actually sees a particular disease, the better they get at treating it. And in addition, university settings have so many resources available to them, and they're usually on top of the latest scientific thinking around a particular disease area.
Here's a concern, though, when it comes to the university hospitals of, you know, like UCLA versus Cedars. Don't you only get to see residents? And they're students, aren't they?
Well, that's the truth, Jillian. So one part of what you said is true. Residents are, in fact, physicians in training.
Okay.
And while you want to make sure let me say a second thing. Residents also are always supervised by an attending physician.
Oh.
A resident cannot treat you without the supervision of someone above them. But this is also what I do, and I encourage patients to do this as well.
Okay.
Depending on my personal situation, I may or may not be comfortable with being treated by a physician in training. And if I'm not comfortable, I simply tell the hospital staff that I prefer to see the attending. I don't want my care to be managed by a resident. And 9 times out of 10, I get what I want.
Really?
Really.
You know, so I love that because the bigger theme to that is that you have to ask for what you need.
Absolutely.
So many people are afraid to ask for what they need, and it's very intimidating, which is another question I have about this. That's a very, you know, those university hospitals are big and intimidating and impersonal. So is there a way to make it any less scary for someone? Is there, you know, is it that simple to ask for an attending physician?
Yes, it can be that simple. But here's one other thing that I find helpful in university hospitals. It's not unusual for them to have a concierge department or a patient services department. And if you find yourself in a situation where you feel like the whole environment is too complex for you, ask them to send someone in who is the hospital's patient advocate. That person can make you comfortable and give you an opportunity to ask the questions that you need to have asked without necessarily feeling intimidated. That can be very helpful.
I've never even heard of that. Janice, have you heard of that?
Well, no, what blows my mind is how much rights we do have to ask these to get this information. That kind of...
Who would know that?
Exactly.
A patient services? A concierge at the hospital?
Yeah.
I've never even heard of that. Yeah. I wouldn't even know that that was available to me.
Well, and the other thing I try to remember for myself and my family, I try to encourage others to remember, is that the medical system is there to serve us, right? The system is supposed to serve us. And there are institutions and physicians who are great at it, and there are physicians and institutions who are bad at it.
Right.
So, Jillian, your point about asking for what you need, I just can't overstate how very important that is.
Okay. So, number three, you say, I have my little prescriptions here. Losing your temper is a losing proposition. Explain what you... Because I've been known to occasionally lose my temper.
So, really?
Not often. No, very rarely. But I was wondering if you could elaborate.
So, Jillian, I have one of my best friends recently had a difficult situation to manage with her husband. And as the caregiver, of course, we all bear huge responsibility when someone in our family is ill. And he had been in the hospital for a while. She felt like she wasn't getting the right kind of response, wasn't getting the right kind of attention that she felt her husband needed. And at a point when she just couldn't take it anymore, she lost her temper, called court in the hall, pointed her finger, shouted at everybody, really stomped her feet, and she kind of left that situation going, well, boy, I really told them. I really gave them a piece of my mind.
Right.
Well, lo and behold, guess who is the least favorite patient on the floor now?
Right.
Her husband. So in trying to effect a change and get someone's attention, she did the exact opposite. She alienated herself, alienated her husband, and really gave herself the reputation and her husband the reputation of being the problem patient. Now, that's not to say that we all don't get upset. You know, when you have a serious health issue to deal with, is it's very, very upsetting. But I have never seen a situation get better because someone loses it in the hallway, runs up and down the hall screaming and yelling, trying to get what they need. I really do suggest that in tough situations, you take a deep breath, you get calm,
right.
You identify the person who has the authority to listen to you and affect a change. You calmly and deliberately walk down your list, and I'll always write things down because when I'm upset, I can't remember all the things I need to say, and then you get upset when someone's walked away and you haven't finished your list. I calmly go through my list, and then, Jillian, if I don't get someone who is saying, I hear you, I am listening, I will follow up, and I will get back to you. If that's not the response I'm getting, I'll ask for the next level of supervisor to have a conversation with. But it's always in a calm, respectful, clear, and direct fashion.
Yeah, I love that because you don't tend to think of things that way. Or at least, you know, when I talk to my shrink about what happens when I lose my temper, you know, he's like, you get rewarded in your head when you think you freak out. It's like that scene with Shirley MacLaine in Terms of Endearment when she loses it and she's like, give my daughter the shot.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that scene, but I think in our minds we get to that point where we think if we yell really loud, if we're really scary, if we're really intimidating, you know, the squeaky wheel. But it's so interesting when you say that you end up creating the very thing that you're most afraid of. They avoid you.
Exactly.
They don't want to go anywhere near you. You alienate yourself. You alienate the person that you're trying to help. And I love that you say to write everything down because I can't think of how many times I've gotten flustered or frustrated and, you know, not written it down. It's like, oh, God, I forgot to ask about X, Y, and Z, and I'm never going to get that person back on the phone. And it allows you to collect your thoughts, calm down, get centered,
and focused.
Exactly.
And you have a game plan. I love that.
And in doing so, Jillian, I think about it like judo and karate. You know, when you do it that way, you keep your power. You know,
right.
when you've completely lost it, and you know you're crying, they're afraid, and you know everyone's looking at you like, oh gosh, there's a crazy lady. You lose so much power that you can't affect the kind of change that you need to for your loved one.
Right. You're absolutely right. This is a lesson not just for the hospital people. I want to make clear. This is a lesson for your life as well. It really is. It's about controlling your emotions. And it's just before we were talking to you, I was talking about a book that I'd written, and in the book it talks about managing your emotions, and I look back at my life and think about how I have wiped out months of work in a moment of impulsivity with emotions that were out of control. Mm-hmm. And this is such an important lesson in this type of environment, and in every environment. You could not be, and that's obviously why you were such an incredibly successful businesswoman as well. Okay, I'm sorry. I digress.
But you know, but just what, you know, yeah. I was just going to say that Myrtle also makes a great point, and then it becomes about you.
Yeah.
If you are the advocate for the person, it all the attention is on me and my emotional breakdown. And all of a sudden, it's not about this person I'm trying to take care of anymore. It's
right.
About me. And I get it.
You've been through hell and back with everything, you taking care of your mom and you.
Yeah, when
really...
you navigate for the elderly, it's. I really appreciate what you're saying. And you know, and you also you get scared to say something. On the other side of the coin, you get scared to say something because if I say something, then they're not going to treat my dad. They're not going to treat my dad good. They're going to do something. They're going to not let him eat. They're not going to. So there's that balance because you can go on the other side where you say nothing because you're so afraid they're not going to care for them.
Yes. So I'm glad you raised that. I'm glad you raised that, Janice, because I think so much can be done when you're trying to talk to somebody about a concern that you have by simply starting with a really clear premise. And the premise is really simple, and it comes through in the statement of, hi, thank you so much for caring for my father. Mm. I know you've been working very hard and we can see the progress. I have some concerns, though, that I'd like to share with you, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to help me. You acknowledge that they're working. You acknowledge that everybody's doing the best they can. You acknowledge that you have a point of view that you're concerned about, and you're asking for their help. I have never seen anyone say, no, 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 I'm not going to help you.
Yeah, true.
If they say, well, I'm not the person to help you, you say, okay, that's fine. Can you please tell me who the person is? Can you give me a name? Can you refer me? Terrific. I thank you for your help. You start from the premise that no one is intending to do any harm.
Ooh.
And it
takes
down
the
defenses.
That's powerful right there. That is so powerful because I think so many of us are so suspicious and we're so jaded, and it's like this system is corrupt and you don't care about me. And I don't want to create sweeping generalizations, but I know in my heart I question the motives of everyone, and I definitely bring that to the table. I love this because that's exactly right. You're right. You come to the table with a clean slate. You leave your baggage at the door.
Absolutely. Because believe me, Jillian, at least this is my opinion, the medical profession right now is so difficult. It's difficult for patients, but it's equally difficult for those who are giving care, doctors and nurses and EMTs and respiratory therapists. These people have really, really tough jobs. So my experience has been that I've not seen anybody in the profession who did not come to the profession with a genuine desire to help other people. But our system right now sure is making it tough on everybody.
So in saying that, your next tip is that doctors are only human. What does that mean? That scares me, Myrtle, by the way. I want to be clear. I like to think of them as magicians.
Exactly.
Yes, they're supposed to be.
Isn't that the truth?
Yes, I like to think of them as like, you know, magicians. They wave their wand and you're cured.
Absolutely. Well, and I like to think of physicians as having being in the best place every single day to focus on me and my needs. And this point came home to me really hard one day. when I went to my physician's office, I waited in the waiting room, and, you know, he's late. He was 15, 20 minutes late. And I started, you know, the self-talk in my head with, my goodness, doesn't he respect my time? And on and on and on and on and on. By the time I got into his office, I looked at him, Jillian. I could tell something was terribly wrong. He just didn't look like himself.
Right.
Well, I took a minute to ask him how he was that day and how was his family. And he shared with me that an hour earlier he'd found out that his father had passed away.
Oh,
that's so
terrible.
There was a moment where I was not doing, I wasn't focusing on my job, and that was to be the best patient I could be. Instead, I was spending my time all wrapped up in whether or not my doctor was performing for me.
Right.
And so I just try to remind people that doctors have kids, doctors have problem kids, doctors have trouble marriages, they have parents that pass away,
right.
They have all the kinds of burdens that you and I hold every day. But the best thing that we can do when we go in to see our doctor is to make sure we are the best patient we can be. And by being the best patient, I like to really encourage people to always have your family medical history in your hands.
The really? Why?
Because
Janice is freaking out. She's like, that's so important.
No, it's
and
so
I'm
true.
Like, why is it so important? Wait,
it's,
why?
It's important because one of the biggest predictors of what kind of health you will have really is the health of your parents, your grandparents, your cousins, your uncles, your aunts. Your history in your family, whether it's the prevalence of disease, whether it's that your father lived until he was 100 or he lived until he was 65, whether or not your family has a history of cancer, all of this information, there's such important clues for a physician to be able to look at to really not only start looking for things in you, but more importantly, to help coach you on lifestyle things around how you eat, how you exercise, whether or not you smoke or not. That kind of coaching is really important to help make sure that you have the best possible outcome regardless of your history.
Okay.
So that medical history is really important. I also believe that it is essential that everywhere you go, you have tucked in your wallet the list of medications that you're taking.
Really? Of course. Oh, God, I never even think of this.
People carry around their driver's license, supposedly because if you get into an accident, you want someone to know who you are.
Yeah.
Even more important than who you are is what medication are you taking?
Oh, my gosh.
Because if you're in the back of an emergency vehicle, whether it's a police car or an ambulance,
yeah,
they can't even begin to treat you without running some risk unless they know the medications you're taking, why you're taking them, the strength, the dose, and the frequency. Really, really important.
What a great piece of information. Why does no one tell you these things? I can't believe I've never heard this before. This is not common knowledge.
Because you're healthy, though. You're healthy, so you probably haven't had to navigate it that much.
Yeah, but what if I was in a car accident 5 minutes from now? Well, I'm
absolutely
not getting in the car in 5 minutes, but today, I mean, what if I was? Accidents happen all the time. I just can't understand why I haven't heard this before. It's frustrating to me.
Well,
but
you know it's important because whenever you go to your doctor's office and they ask you to fill out the form.
Yeah, okay.
Five questions in are what medications on you are you on? How long have you been taking them?
Even the vitamins. They even want to know the vitamins that I take.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right because they can interact with other medications as well. So the last thing that I really think is important in terms of doing your part as a patient is be really clear about your symptoms when you're going in to see a doctor. You know, if you've had flu symptoms for 3 days, that's a very different picture than if you've had flu symptoms for a month.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So not only knowing what your symptoms are, how long you've had them, what have you done to relieve them or to make them better that have or have not worked,
mm.
giving that giving that little story about what you're coming in for and being as precise as possible is really helpful, even if it means, once again, that you're writing notes down and you're taking your notes in with you.
Gotcha. Okay. And prescription number 5, practice routine maintenance. What do you mean?
Yes. I think one of the most disruptive things that can happen to a family is to find a family member who's turned suddenly ill.
Okay.
And it's not unusual for all the attention to be placed on making the ill person better, that the little things that are happening in your life that keep you feeling like your life isn't spinning out of control, those are the things that go by the wayside. So, for example, if as a family you always had Sunday dinner where all the kids came over, if there is any way to still have that Sunday dinner, it's so important, especially when there are children involved. You know, my father was recently hospitalized because he has a heart condition and also has kidney problems. He's 84 years old, aging, and seeing some of the things that wouldn't be all that surprising. But one of the things that was very important to him was to continue to have his 4 newspapers a day to read. The man reads 4 newspapers a day, and I'll be doggone, we might not have been able to find his preferred papers, but every day we got him 4 newspapers. It was just a little thing that helped him feel like everything in his life wasn't just spinning out of control.
Right. I can see how incredibly important that is. We are such creatures of habit, and even just having that little piece of your routine when you're not sick, when you're just feeling overwhelmed, or when you're going through a divorce, or you're going through a life change, being able to have that little bit of normalcy allows you to feel grounded, like you don't totally, you know, not recognize yourself or your life. These are, Myrtle, everything you're saying, it's fascinating to me because, you know, I listen to Susie Orman talk about money, and when she talks about money, you can apply all those things to your life.
Yeah.
When I talk about fitness, you can apply all those things to your life. And as you're talking about healthcare, these are major life lessons. This applies to every area of your life, as well as, of course, this specific issue, which is so scary for so many people.
Yes.
It really is. And what is so special to me about what you're doing is that you've left the most lucrative career to pursue this because it's your passion to help people and to share this information with the world. So I need to tell people right now, because Janice was like, how can we find her? She just literally wrote on a piece of paper, does she have a site the audience can go to?
Well, that's just such great information.
Yeah. How do people get in touch with you? How do they get more from you? Obviously, I'm going to have you on every month. And I would love is for us to be able to take questions. So everybody out there listening who wants to ask Myrtle a question, get it ready. I'm going to take it off of Facebook, so you'll be able to ask her directly and let her know what's going on with you. But, you know, for the few people that get to do that, how does everyone else get in touch with you?
So my new company that I've started was established for one purpose, Jillian, and that's to help consumers navigate the healthcare system. I have a really small site that's been established, and the address for that site is www.myrtlepotter.com.
And that's myrtlepotter.com.
Yes. And what consumers can expect is that over the next couple of months that site will grow in terms of its presence. In addition, consumers will also be able to see me in their doctor's offices on a closed network television system starting in July.
What?
Where, as you're sitting in the doctor's office waiting to be seen, if your physician subscribes to Accent Health Television, you will see me and my tips being shown right there in the physician's offices. And it'll reference you back to my website as well as the website of Everyday Health.
Wow. Myrtle, thank you so much. This has truly been an enlightening segment. Can't even tell you. I'm so excited to be learning more from you and to be working with you.
Well, I thank you, Jillian. I admire you so much, and I in particular, I admire your commitment to helping people live bigger, fuller and healthier lives. And I ask and invite the listeners to also follow me.
Yes.
On Twitter. My Twitter name is Myrtle Potter.
Why am I not following you on Twitter?
I'm going to follow you, Jillian.
I didn't know you were on Twitter. I'm following you on Twitter right now. I'm on my phone.
Following Myrtle.
I'm like this. I'm furious that I didn't know. Okay, but what about Facebook? No Facebook yet? Just Twitter?
Oh, I'm on Facebook, and you'll find me on Facebook, Myrtle Potter, the Trusted Voice in Healthcare.
Got it.
If you just even look up the Trusted Voice in Healthcare, you'll find me on Facebook.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, buddy. I can't wait to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much, Jillian. I'm so proud to be with you, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to share a little bit of knowledge that may help some people.
Kidding me? We thank you for being on, and I would go follow you right now. Have a great day, buddy.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, we got time for one call, and Charlene is waiting on the line.
Hey, Charlene, how are you?
I am well. How are you, Jillian?
I'm good, buddy. What's going on?
I'm trying to get my life together so that I can just be fabulous all the time.
Well, I hear you. So am I.
Well, you're a little closer than I am.
Oh, well, tell me, what's keeping you from the goal?
It's the feeling that I deserve my weekends. I do really well during the week. I plan my food, even on Sunday nights. I go to the grocery store, prepare, do everything, get my exercise in, you know, vary it up. Friday night, Saturday night, out with friends. Just really want to go and do something. And I feel like I deserve my cheese and crackers and my glass of wine, and it kind of falls apart from there.
Okay. This is not an unfamiliar conversation for me. Mm-hmm. I've had this conversation with many people in this position. First of all, why are you counting your calories to begin with?
I'm about 70 pounds overweight.
Okay.
So been what working do you, on it for years, but, back and forth.
So you're 70 pounds overweight. What do you want?
Just to be fitter, you know. And
be more specific.
I want to be back under 200 pounds. I want to see that 199, which I think will just motivate me to keep it.
What is it, and what does being under 200 pounds mean to you?
I think it's just the ability to walk in a store and buy whatever I want, you know, and not be isolated to the fat girl section.
It means being fashionable, okay?
Right, fashionable.
Okay. What else?
It means health for me, you know. I know for every pound I have on my body, it's making my heart and my knees, you know, work a little harder.
So it's when you say health, it's described in your mind as physical comfort, not being in pain?
Right. And I'm not in pain, but I know there's some limitations, or did some yard work the other day and did about 6 hours of raking and picking up leaves and dirt, you know, from the winter, and just realized that I... You know, the next day I'm really sore. Those are muscles that I'm not using.
Okay, but here's the thing. You know, I'm trying to create something for you that's worth fighting for. And raking leaves for 6 hours is not sexy.
Right.
Cheese
oh,
is
I know.
Sexier than that. So you have got to come up with something, a reason that you want to lose this weight, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
So being fashionable, that's one thing.
Right.
Not being in physical pain, that's another thing. But it's going to have to be the kind of thing where when you think about deservedness, you think about deserving a life that is healthier and happier with a vision of deserving a pain-free body, deserving, and you know, being able to wear fashionable clothes. I need answers from you, real answers, not generalizations. Generalizations
okay.
Like raking leaves, no one cares about that,
right.
Including you. So
right.
What else do you have?
I want to look sexy in a pair of black jeans and... You know, a nice top. I want to have the, as I call them, the Angelina Jolie arms.
Okay.
And that also brings me a sense of self-confidence when I walk in a room.
Okay. Okay. So you want confidence when you walk in a room.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And I want you to keep going, by the way, from here. So it's like,
okay.
I want to feel confident. I want to feel sexy. I want to feel good in my clothes. I want to look fashionable. All those things. Okay?
Okay.
Those are all important. So now... When you're getting to the weekend and you're thinking, I deserve, I need you to gain a little perspective, and I need you to think that you deserve to wear the clothes you want. You deserve to feel sexy. You deserve to feel confident.
Right.
And when you think about those things, those deeper things, it's going to be more important to you. It will outweigh your passion for cheese and wine and overeating. Because here's the thing. You can put all this work in during the week, and that's great. But if you go crazy on the weekend, you're basically canceling one out for the other.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably not actively gaining weight, but you're probably not actively losing weight. You're in neutral, which is better than being in reverse. Okay. Mm-hmm. However, the deprivation, the issue of I deserve, this is a tricky issue. And it generally has to do with feeling deprived of something deeper. And then we go to that real pop psychology stuff of like, you know, what's the true hunger that you have? What are you really hungering for? It's not what you're eating, it's what's eating you. But as stupid and cliche as that sounds, it's true.
Right.
So you've got to look at, where are you feeling like your needs are not getting met?
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got to find ways of fulfilling those needs that are life-affirming and not destructive. So there's deeper work and then there's surface work to manage symptoms. So what is it that you truly feel like you're not getting?
Oh, just being in a relationship and being in love.
Okay. Let me tell you something. Why are you not in a relationship? Why are you not in love?
Just I feel like that my outer beauty does not match my inner beauty.
Okay.
I've been told I have a dynamic personality that if people got to know me, they would understand.
Okay.
You know.
All right. We got a couple of problems with that. Number one, you're lovable now.
Right.
And you'll be lovable if you're thin. You're lovable both ways.
Right.
So, but this is going to be a baby step process. So another thing, when you think about getting slimmer, you think about having a more passionate love life.
Mm-hmm.
That's more important to you than cheese.
Okay. Yes, it is.
So when I ask you and you talk about raking leaves,
mm-hmm.
do you see the massive disconnect?
Yes.
Okay. So, all right. Now, you're feeling like that hole in your heart on a deeper level. You're not feeling fulfilled romantically.
Mm-hmm.
You're not feeling like, are you feeling loved? Do you feel loved in other areas?
Oh, yes. I have a lot of friends that, you know, love me in a different way, you know, kind of thing.
I
have a wonderful son and stuff like that. But the one-on-one passion with a man is not happening right
now.
Got
it. Fair enough. All right. So when we get to the weekend and it's like, I deserve this. Sure you do. There's a sense of entitlement, probably needs that didn't get met when you were a kid. Things that you know, you weren't taken care of in the way you wanted to be or in the way you needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I need you to gain that perspective of the things you want versus the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And then I need you to find another way of nurturing yourself, giving to yourself, that is not destructive. So it could be anything. It could be, you know, for me, it's like I like to go ride my horse.
Mm-hmm.
I take a bubble bath. Sometimes I let myself stay home and do nothing. And that is big for me. That is like a massive indulgence. I indulge myself. I'll go get a manicure, pedicure. I'll get a massage. I will, you know, work on a hobby that I love to work on. I'll go for a ride on my motorcycle. What can you do to reward yourself and to nurture yourself and give to yourself that isn't hurting yourself?
Mm-hmm.
That's the symptom management.
Okay. Yes. Yes. And that's it. I can get a mani-pedi because then I think my feet are sexy.
You feel beautiful.
Yeah.
You have to engage in behaviors that make you feel beautiful. And generally, grooming is a great tip. So when you say bubble bath or when you say color your hair or when you say get your nails done or get a massage, that stuff is all exercise would be one. I would love to see you go out dancing with friends or, you know, even walk the dog or play ball with your son. I don't know how old he is. But things that are going to make you feel beautiful and are still nurturing and are still rewarding. And even if it's I did nothing today, fine. As long as it's not destructive. And in the meantime, you need to really start thinking about the life that you want,
mm-hmm.
putting these things in perspective, and also start doing the deeper work on being deserving of love at whatever weight you're at.
Okay. Yep.
Okay.
That sounds fabulous. And that's it. You know, that's it. The friends I go out with or that are, they're at their goals or they're, you know, they're thinner or something, you know. And that's why I've always felt like I deserve to do this. If they can do it, I can do it. So.
Of course they can.
Yes.
Of course you can.
Yes. Yes.
But put a game plan together, like I told you. Write it all down, all right? I'm going to send you a book. I'm going to have Janice get your information. I'm going to send you Unlimited. I want you to read it.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
All right, Mama. Thank you, and I want you to read that book.
I will. I will. I promise.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks, Jillian.
Bye.
We got to go.
You're always running out the door.
I'm always running.
Go check your gate.
Go check my gate.
Check your gate.
I'm going to go get my hooves checked and get my gate.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening.
Peace.
And it starts sometime around midnight. Or at least that's when you lose yourself for a minute or two. As you stand under the bar lights and the band plays some song about forgetting yourself for a while, and the piano's this melancholy soundtrack to her smile, in that white dress she's wearing you haven't seen her for a while.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.